dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is your intelligence briefing for Monday, the 15th of May. We're going to get you up to speed with what you need to know to be an effective citizen soldier in this war of ideas, this ongoing war for the free world. I'll be your guest host. My name is Kyle Scheidler, the director of the Threat Information Office here at the Center for Security Policy. I'll be stepping into the captain's chair for the great Frank Gaffney. Let's dive right in. Major developments over the weekend on the Korean Peninsula, including yet another missile test from the North Koreans, who launched what they insist was a nuclear-capable ballistic missile. This is yet another escalation from the North Koreans and a serious challenge to the new South Korean president, who ran on a platform calling for new talks and de-escalation. Here to enlighten us on this developing situation and more, our duty expert on the Far East, author of Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World, and The Coming Collapse of China, a good friend of Secure Freedom Radio, Gordon Chang. Gordon, welcome.
Thank you so much, Kyle.
It seems to me that, you know, we have a situation here with North Korea, series of missile tests. Is this really about testing technology, or is this about sending a message? And if so, what message are they sending, and are we, the United States, reading them loud and clear?
Yeah, I think they're both, Kyle. Clearly, this missile test yesterday morning was a big advancement for the North Koreans. This could very well have been an intercontinental ballistic missile. We're not quite clear how far this thing could go if it were fired on a normal trajectory. But the North Koreans were probably pretty close to the mark when they said that this thing traveled 787 kilometers downrange, and it reached a very high altitude of 2,111 kilometers. If they had fired this as you normally would, this probably was on the edge of what we consider to be an intercontinental ballistic missile. President Trump at the beginning of this year tweeted that the North Koreans weren't going to fire such a missile. Now that they have or may have, we've got to see what the response from Washington will be. As for the message that this thing sent to neighbors, I think clearly the most important message was to China. China was holding its Belt and Road Forum, which was the major initiative of Xi Jinping in the foreign policy area. And so clearly this was not a friendly note to the Chinese. Also, this thing landed about 60 or so miles off the coast of Russia. So Putin must have felt a little bit uncomfortable. And as you point out, this missile was tested just a week after the Tuesday election of Moon Jae-in of the Korea Democratic Party, a very sort of pro-North Korean figure. This wasn't very good for him either. So North Korea is just taking on everybody at the same time. And if we want to go back in history to find another figure who did this, to take on all the neighbors simultaneously, that probably would be Mao Zedong of China.
That's an interesting point that you raised. North Koreans really kind of isolating themselves even further from even their closest neighbor. And if one could say they had an ally, their ally China. So President Trump has made quite a bit about his relationship with the Chinese president. He clearly seems to think this is an important budding relationship. And he's said he's willing to link Chinese trade deals with Chinese assistance on North Korea. But given this recent sort of thumbing their nose at China, how much assistance can China really offer us? And are they inclined to do so?
Well, they're not inclined to do so. But China actually could solve this problem. China accounts for 90% of North Korea's external trade, about 90% or more of North Korea's crude oil, much of it on concessionary terms. The most important thing that China supplies, though, is not material or diplomatic support. It's confidence to regime members. It's the confidence that they are safe from South Korea, that they're safe from the United States, that they're safe from the rest of the world. And I don't know if China could convince Kim Jong-un to change his mind. I don't think anybody really could. But what China could do is it could convince senior regime elements that it was no longer in their interest to support Kim and to support the weaponization programs. There's a very transactional relationship Kim now has with people in Pyongyang. And China, if it wanted to, could peel them off. But I don't think Beijing does. It has not made a strategic calculus to change long-held, decades-long policies. And by the way, they are formal military allies, China and North Korea. You know, President Trump, as you point out, is now looking to China. He's subordinated a lot of U.S. policy to this. He's given the Chinese passes on trade, South China Sea, Taiwan, you name it. If this North Korea gamble doesn't work, this will be a debacle for the United States. And we need to be very careful about what's going on, because the United States could lose across the board to some very risky policy. I'm not blaming Trump. It very well may work. And if he does defang North Korea, this is going to be a monumental triumph. But we're very far from that point, Kyle.
You mentioned that Trump was banking quite a bit on Chinese assistance here. And one of the things that is important to Trump, as we know, is trade deals. Now, the Chinese, as you mentioned, recently held their Belt and Road Initiative over the weekend. Now, they're talking about this new Silk Road project, nearly $1 trillion in infrastructure projects to, quote unquote, you know, unite the global economy, as the Chinese tell it. This seems to be the kind of project that runs very much counter to what President Trump ran on during the campaign, you know, with his slogan of buy American, hire American. And if Trump has doubts about this, he's not the only one. We know that the Indians, for example, chose not to attend as well. But we did send a delegation to that meeting.
We sent Matt Pattinger. And so, you know, we supported this initiative, which is really questionable.
Why do you think we did that?
Well, I think it's because the Chinese asked Trump to, and, you know, Trump is willing to give them everything at this particular time. This early harvest trade deal that was announced by Wilbur Ross on Thursday by the Commerce Department, you know, is supposed to help reduce our trade deficit with China. But if you start looking at the parts of it, it looks like it might actually increase the deficit by giving China access to the U.S. banking market and also giving China the right to sell poultry parts in the United States. So this is going to be something we've got to look at very carefully, because we got some benefits out of this trade deal, or an interim trade deal, but they're not that important, I think. And so, you know, when we step back, we're going to have to see how this actually works out. If Trump actually did make a big concession to the Chinese on trade, we have got to get something on North Korea, and very quickly, because right now the North Koreans are making very fast progress on their missiles. We know that they've put away a device deep into a tunnel, about to set off their sixth device. So, you know, the North Koreans are just, with China's help, are making very fast progress, and we've got to take a note of that.
You noticed, you said that we need to get something from China quick on North Korea. What do you think, what signal would we see that they were going to move forward with helping us? How would we know?
If they cut off crude oil, it's hard to tell because there are pipelines. But nonetheless, if we saw shipments of crude oil either severely curtailed or ended, that would be a real indication that China has changed its mind on North Korea. And especially if we saw those crude oil cutoffs last a long time. You know, the Chinese have cut off crude oil, and they did that in 2003 for about 3 days. That was sort of a signal to the North Koreans to try to start talks. But if we saw a prolonged shutoff of crude oil, yes, that would be important. We'd also need to see an end to all coal purchases. On February 18th, the Chinese announced that they were no longer going to buy North Korean coal for the rest of this year in order to comply with UN sanctions. But the Chinese bought coal in February after that announcement, and they bought coal in March and April. So we need to see a shutoff of all coal purchases. You know, you just go down the line. We need to see an end of commerce between China and North Korea. That would be a real signal that they have changed that calculus in Beijing. So far, that's far from being the case.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Gordon. I think you raised some really important points. And if they do move forward with what you described as that sixth test, then I think it will definitely be a challenge for the Trump administration. Gordon, thank you very much. Next up, we'll be talking to Michael Cutler of the Californians for Population and Stabilization here on Secure Freedom Radio.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Joining us now here on Secure Freedom Radio is retired Special Agent of the Immigration and Naturalization Services, Senior Fellow for Californians for Population Stabilization, Michael Cutler. Michael, thanks for coming on.
My privilege, my pleasure. Thanks for covering the topics and having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Michael, I wanted to talk to you about something that I think amounts to almost a potential nullification crisis within the American polity, and that's this question of sanctuary cities. Now, President Trump has said Andrew Jackson is the president he looks to, and now we've got he's got his own nullification crisis, as these cities simply refuse to observe the law. Now, in Andrew Jackson's time, South Carolina backed down. If President Trump continues to make good on his efforts to enforce federal law, how do you think the left's going to respond?
Well, they're going to be in a state of rage. But, you know, Americans, irrespective of their political orientation, you know, I'm registered as a Democrat. I've always voted as an independent. I hate both political parties. But any rational American ought to understand that a nation's security begins and ends at its borders. If you come to think about it, our military's mission is to protect our borders at a distance, while the role of immigration, the Department of Homeland Security, is to protect our borders up close and in person. They don't just exist along the Mexican border, by the way. Any state that has an international airport or a seaport or lies along the northern as well as the southern borders are all border states. So when you're sending a message to people from around the world that if you can get to that particular state or that particular college campus, we now have sanctuary campuses, that they will be shielded, what's really happening is that national security and public safety are being undermined, as is the well-being of every American. And, you know, the 9/11 Commission, to which I provided testimony, made it clear that primarily 9/11 and other terrorist attacks were directly attributable to multiple failures of the immigration system.
Michael, one of the things you were speaking about, and I know you have a new piece at Front Page Magazine about this, is that the situation with illegal immigration may actually be far worse than we know. Why is that?
Yes. Well, you know, it's funny because I always look at this fascination that we have with statistics. You know, figures don't lie, but liars can figure, and sometimes it's done innocently. But if you look at the Reagan Amnesty, 1986, which was a component of the Immigration Reform and Control Act of that year, which finally, for the first time, made knowingly hiring illegal aliens a violation of law, the estimate was that 1 million illegal aliens would emerge from those proverbial shadows and participate in the amnesty program. We wound up with between 3.5 and 4 million. We're being told there's about 11 or 12 million now. But, you know, 10 years ago, the Congressional Budget Office also estimated that there were about 12 million illegals. That's impossible that the number has not increased, although some people would have you believe that. So what's not being discussed are false claims to U.S. citizenship. And what triggered the article that I wrote for Front Page, it's something that I've been thinking about for a very long time, because the analysts at the think tanks and so forth mean well, I think most of them do, but they don't have real-world experience. And there's a big difference between the hypothetical world of academia and the real world where the rubber meets the road. As an immigration agent, I frequently encountered illegal aliens who claimed to be American citizens. And upon questioning, and we were trained at our academy as immigration officers to break false claims the way that the Secret Service is taught how to spot counterfeit money. And we would ultimately break the false claim. Because there's such a shortage of immigration agents doing interior enforcement, and you have sanctuary cities shielding these folks from detection, I doubt strongly that those sanctuary cities, and perhaps other cities as well, have not given their people the training to detect a false claim. So the guy that's sitting in jail who was charged with a felony might be from the Dominican Republic, let's say, or Ecuador, but in reality or being processed or during the time of being processed may well falsely claim to be from Puerto Rico. And there was just an ICE press release that said this: 15 illegal aliens arrested in East Texas identity theft. East Texas for identity theft. And here you had people that had gamed the E-Verify system by getting birth certificates of other people. And they were working at Port Arthur and other critical infrastructure. So when people say, well, mandatory E-Verify is the solution, for example, we have to make it mandatory. But if you don't have agents out there to conduct the audits and the interviews and the field investigations, that system can be gamed. You have employers who hire people off the books. So they have E-Verify, but they're not hiring everybody through the system. They just hire a handful through the lawful system. So what I really believe is that instead of the 12 million that we're told may be here illegally, that number could be 3 or 4 times as many. Now, imagine the impact this would have. And most politicians that want this amnesty program, they, of course, will say it's not an amnesty, but a massive legalization program, want to downplay the numbers and therefore the impact this would have on America and Americans. So if we look at it with the critical eye of the experienced agent, which is what I provide in these situations, I think what we're looking at is a far greater crisis than most of the politicians are willing to concede. And sanctuary cities feed that problem, exacerbate it, because I doubt that they're really looking too hard at who these people are that are in their prisons or that are living within their community. So I really believe that the estimates we're hearing are woefully wrong, and the dangers that exist are much greater than we're told.
Speaking about dishonest statistics and downplaying the risks, I wanted to get your thoughts on a recent piece at the American Statesman where some Democratic sheriffs, including from Texas counties, argued that, in fact, sanctuary cities have a lower level of crime, including lower rates of homicide, than non-sanctuary cities. And they claim that FBI crime statistics back them up on that. Your thoughts?
Well, my thoughts are, first of all, chiefs of police are political figures. Most serve at the pleasure or displeasure of their mayors, governors, and so forth. So they know what they have to say to please their superiors. You know, about 10 or 11 years ago, I had the privilege of addressing the executive board of the International Association of Chiefs of Police. And I would say that 90% of the people in the audience, there was a huge turnout, and these were police chiefs from around the country, told me that if they dared to say the things that I said but that they agreed with, that they would lose their jobs by the end of the day. So they were coerced by the political process to say whatever it was that needed to be said, and I chastised them. I said, you know, you're placing at risk not only the men and women dedicated to your department, but you're placing at risk the people who live within your jurisdictions. And I said, someone's got to have the chutzpah to come forward with the truth. You know, one of the lies we hear is that criminals would be shielded by the people living in the communities if the people in the communities were fearful of immigration authorities arresting them if they reported that they fell victim to a crime. It's one of the most disgusting lies I've ever heard. You know, the notion that immigration agents are going to charge into a hospital and pull a woman out of the hospital who was raped and deport her because she's here illegally is crazy. There are visas that can be provided to illegal aliens who cooperate with law enforcement to help catch the people who attack them. There are also visas available for aliens who are here illegally if they provide information about ongoing major criminal activities, whether it's drug trafficking rings, gangs like MS-13, or international terror organizations. In fact, when I was assigned to the Drug Task Force, half my career was with the Drug Task Force. I was also over at DEA Intel. I had desks at the FBI, DEA, and ATF. One of my responsibilities was to cultivate informants using my immigration authority. You see, the lie that's being perpetrated goes exactly against what the reality is. Immigration enforcement helps those immigrant communities because they are the folks most likely to be injured by ethnic criminal aliens. And by the way, this isn't just within the Latino community. It's the Russian mob, it's Asian organized crime. It's the Jamaican drug posses, European criminals, Israeli Middle Eastern gangs. The reason I say this authoritatively is I've arrested thugs of every flavor imaginable, because at the end of the day, human nature is human nature. It knows no race, religion, ethnicity, or national origin. It's just the nature of the human beast.
That's an excellent point, Michael. Unfortunately, we are out of time. I really appreciate your thoughts on this, and we look forward to talking to you again next time here on Secure Freedom Radio.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. I'm your host, guest host for today, Kyle Scheindler. Joining us now, he is a 2015 Publius Fellow, Claremont Institute, contributor at the Federalist, City Journal, and Conservative Review, one of the best up-and-coming conservative thinkers, I think, Benjamin Weingarten. Ben, thanks for coming on.
Kyle, thanks for the kind introduction, and always a pleasure.
So I wanted to talk to you about, you're a media critic, you keep your eyes on the U.S. media, and we've really reached a level of just absolutely hyperbolic claims. You know, Washington Post, democracy dies in the darkness, New York Times running ads about how they are the last best hope for the truth in an ever-increasing and darkening time. And one of the ironies here is that, of course, there are real places in the world where democracy is very much dying in the darkness. And one of them is Turkey. And I'd like to get your thoughts on how it is that the media misses these places where real democracy is under threat.
Well, you make a great point there about the media's focus in the Trump era, which has been to portray the entire American system of democracy, although, of course, we're a republic, as being under threat from this potentially fascistic dictator, and how all of the norms of American politics are being thrown out the window, and thus we should be panicking and in hysteria. But you have to question whether or not there's any intellectual honesty in our media when many of the folks at the leading journal institutions in the country are focusing on the death of democracy in America, when in a place like Turkey, we're actually seeing the overturning after almost 100 years of a relatively secular, liberal nation, majority Muslim nation, which in and of itself is nothing to ignore. And now, after a recent referendum, dictatorial autocratic powers between the executive, legislative, and judicial branches have all been now housed in the presidency, in Erdogan's regime. That's a major fundamental transformation of a nation by Erdogan from, again, this relatively secular, liberal country where the military played a great role in keeping it that way, to a nation now which went from an Ataturk country to an Erdogan Islamist regime, which is essentially an Islamic fascist regime now, under an Erdogan with almost unlimited powers and control over a country. That should be a major news story. This should be another exclamation point on the Arab Spring turn to winter, and it's not. And I think that should make everyone question whether or not the media cares about what's actually going on in the world, or if it's about solely peddling a political narrative that hurts the, you know, the red team instead of the blue team.
I think that's an excellent point. You know, President Obama often touted his really good relationship with President Erdogan. And all of a sudden, the media quietly sort of started to ignore that. They started to simply, you know, when things got bad in Turkey, they just stopped covering it. And, of course, it's not that interesting things aren't happening in Turkey. You had the coup. You have reports of Turkish involvement with supporting al-Qaeda militias in Syria. You have Turkish support for the terrorist organization Hamas. And yet there seems to be this complacency bias where everyone simply wants to treat it as if it was the same old NATO ally Turkey that it always had been. What do you think leads policymakers to this refusal to recognize new facts?
Well, I think that a large part of it is that either A, they've bought into a narrative which says that Erdogan, while he may say and do some unsavory things, is an essential player in the world, and in particular with respect to jihadists, and thus even though on some areas he's bad, on other areas we share intelligence, and theoretically the Turks are actually targeting some of the same groups that we would target if we had control of the situation. But all of that said, the willful blindness that you point out is an essential thing, and that is when people are met with facts that don't comport with the narrative that they have been taught and bought hook, line, and sinker over the years, it's very difficult often for them to admit the sort of cognitive dissonance that actually the reality is different from the one that they've assumed all along. And in the case of Erdogan, he was portrayed as someone who, while somewhat of an Islamist, was someone that you could sort of do business with. And the fact of the matter is that under Erdogan, Turkey has undermined in many ways operations that would be useful to the U.S. He has not been a bulwark against jihadis, but rather he's encouraged them in many cases. He's clearly been anti-Semitic and anti-Israeli in his comments and sought to undermine Israel's security, which also undermines America's national interests as well. And it's important that you brought up the point about NATO. Oh, I should also say on the point of Erdogan that he used the refugee crisis to essentially blackmail Europe for billions of dollars, turning on and off the spigot of refugees cynically to collect money from the Europeans. But the NATO point is crucial because in NATO, one of the points of the doctrine of NATO or the principles of NATO that's essential is that the countries that serve as a part of it are aligned in terms of their interests, in terms of their ideology, in terms of the nature of the governments at play. Turkey does not meet the standards of being a NATO country at this point when you have an autocratic Islamist regime as opposed to a relatively secular and liberal one.
I think that's an excellent point. And, you know, you were talking about how it is that these autocrats successfully snow, you know, American policymakers who just want to buy into their rhetoric. And this is a trick that it seems, you know, almost every bit player and terrorist across the globe has caught on to. Most recently, we saw Hamas, which we mentioned earlier, with their further close ties to Turkey, putting on, a new coat and a new hat and claiming to be born again. Is this the same old Hamas, or has the leopard really changed its spots this time?
It's absolutely the same old Hamas. It's the same players, and it's just different rhetoric. Many of these jihadi groups in the region, and I count Hamas among them, are very smart when it comes to how they portray themselves and propagandize with respect to the West. Not just Hamas, but let's also look at a group like Hezbollah, for example. They have their sort of military arm, and then they have a quote-unquote humanitarian or political arm. So they're able to portray themselves as doing positive things for peoples within the regions in which they are controlling. And at the same time, they have their quote-unquote resistance or armed struggle. And they try to justify that in the language that appeals to leftists in the West, which is essentially that we are freedom fighters struggling against an oppressive occupier regime. And that's the exact sort of rhetoric you see in the new principles. I don't know that it's exactly actually a new charter, even though it's been quoted as such, but the new principles that Hamas put out. And what they do is very cleverly say now, we're not anti-Semites. We don't hate Jews. We just hate Zionists. And we don't wish to destroy Israel, but we wish to control all the land to the sea. And essentially, it's just a rhetorical trick. What they're doing is they're stripping out the elements that are overtly indicating that Hamas wishes to destroy Israel. And instead, they're talking about a more progressive path towards it or a more political path towards it. But of course, within the charter itself or the document itself, when you go down to the end of it, they talk very explicitly about the fact that jihad is not only an okay tactic, but it is a necessary tactic. Armed struggle is essential, and they do not at all disavow jihadist attacks on Israeli civilians or military figures. So it's very clear that the nature of Hamas has not changed at all, but it has sought to A, separate itself to some degree from its past rhetoric, and B, separate itself from the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, which is both tactical and strategic. Tactical in the sense of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt being identified as a terrorist group by numerous regimes in the region, and strategic from the perspective of seeking to have better relations with Sisi in Egypt, who poses a threat to Hamas in many respects.
Well, that's a good point, Ben, and I wish we had more time to get into it, but unfortunately we are out of time. Ben Weingarten, thanks for joining us here on Secure Freedom Radio.
to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. I'm joined now by Megan Oprea, the senior contributor for The Federalist. She's also responsible for Inbound, a daily foreign affairs news and insight email blast that is really essential to get on. So if you are not receiving Inbound, you are making a mistake. She's also the 2017 Claremont Lincoln Fellow. Congratulations for that. And Megan, welcome aboard here on Secure Freedom Radio.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's my pleasure. I wanted to get into some developments in the Afghanistan theater that you covered recently. You were talking about the assessment made by the Director of National Intelligence, Dan Coats. And needless to say, the situation in Afghanistan is not good. It hasn't been covered a lot in the media, but things are not going the way U.S. forces want them to go. What's gone wrong and how do we change it?
Yeah, so part of what's going on is what we're seeing is a resurgence of the Taliban in Afghanistan, and it feels just like a record that's skipping. We keep hearing about this, right? It's been 16 years, and it's almost hard to believe that it's still an ongoing problem, but the Taliban is increasingly gaining territory. And part of what's contributing to this is the fact that we turned over, you know, all combat operations to Afghan security forces, and they just don't appear to be up to task.
That's a good point. You know, we very much based our policy on the idea that the Afghans needed to take the lead in their own security, and they either can't or won't. Now, U.S. forces, for the most part, are not engaging with the Taliban, and some of that has to do with the just continued desire by U.S. policymakers to reach some kind of negotiated settlement with the Taliban. Is that any closer to taking place?
It does not seem to be any closer. And you know, the Taliban doesn't really have a lot of incentives to come to the negotiating table because they're doing quite well. And they are moving ahead of pace in terms of gaining power in Afghanistan. So there's not really much of a motivation for them to come to the negotiating tables.
That's a good point. And I think it's one of the problems that we have in Afghanistan is we don't know what peace would look like in the sense that we don't know what Afghanistan we would be comfortable leaving looks like, because it's questionable whether it has ever existed in history. You know, are we comfortable with an autocratic Afghanistan? Are we comfortable with an Islamist Afghanistan as long as it's not held by the Taliban? These are serious questions that policymakers need to grapple with. Megan, Are they even asking the right questions here?
You know, it doesn't seem like they are, and I think you made some really good points about the tension between what are we comfortable with between an autocratic leader versus you know, allowing Islamism to sort of take hold. But yeah, I don't think we're asking the right questions, and I think right now we're in sort of this sort of emergency mindset of, okay, we have to, you know, plug the dam, we have to stop the bleeding. And I don't even think anyone's thinking about what kind of end state we would like, which is a problem in our foreign policy across the globe.
I think that's very true. There's also this point that has grabbed on to American policymakers now since Colin Powell made it a while back, and that was the classic, you broke it, you bought it line. And there's this idea that we have somehow bought Afghan security, and we're responsible for it from now until the end of time. Is that really in America's national interest, or is there a period where the juice may be not worth the squeeze when it comes to Afghanistan and it's time to simply get out?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good point that we can't just be committed there forever, but I think that there would be a way to be committed there for a while longer and still try to seek an outcome that would be in our best interest. And I do think stability in Afghanistan is in our best interest, and I think the Taliban taking back over would be a bad thing for U.S. national security, as well as for our allies across the region. But it's a tricky question of how long do you stay, and at what point do you just sort of, you know, cut and run. But part of the problem is that we keep trying to cut and run too early, and we saw this in Iraq as well. And it creates more instability and ultimately makes us obliged to be there even longer.
I think that's a good point. And, of course, as a global power, we have responsibilities all across the globe. And our concentration in Afghanistan means that we may be taking our eye off the ball somewhere else. And one of the things you noted recently that I thought was important was the situation in the Baltics, and particularly Lithuania. Now, the Baltic states are looking at a very aggressive Russia. And, of course, cutting deals with Russia was one of the things that was necessary for us to operate in Afghanistan. So what are the concerns that the Baltic states have, and how is the U.S. meeting them or failing to meet them when it comes to security in the region?
Yeah, so the Baltic states are very concerned right now that Russia is trying to sort of exert itself and bring back its sphere of influence in Eastern Europe, much like it did in Ukraine in the last several years. And so they're very concerned about this. There's upcoming in September massive military exercises that Russia is going to be doing in Belarus. So Lithuania, the other Baltic states are very, very concerned, and they're basically asking the U.S. for support. And the president of Lithuania last week said that she would like to have a permanent U.S. military presence in Lithuania in addition to the NATO forces.
Why do you think that's important to Lithuania that they're U.S.-led rather than simply some other NATO force?
I think they understand the power and sway that the U.S. holds, and that Russia is going to is not going to be deterred as easily by NATO if it knows that the U.S. doesn't really have its heart in it. So I think that it would be a huge symbolic statement if the U.S. were to have a permanent U.S. military presence there. And it, as the Lithuanian president pointed out, it wouldn't just be for deterrence. It could potentially be for defense. And I think Russia would respect that show of force.
Of course, President Trump's feelings on NATO have been at best mixed. During the campaign, he had some serious questions about whether European allies were meeting their responsibilities. But since then, he's taken somewhat softer approach to it, and he seems to be a little bit more respectful of at least the notion of what NATO's supposed to be. Can President Trump make NATO relevant? Can he get the Europeans to step up to the plate when it comes to enforcing their own security? Or does it really have to be, as the Lithuanians seem to think, the Americans first and foremost?
I think it can be both. I think you're right that President Trump has definitely toned down his rhetoric about NATO and acknowledged its usefulness. But other countries have also taken note. Lithuania itself is working hard to get to that 2% national spending that Trump has been asking for. So I think that there's a little bit of both. I do think some of these countries, especially in the Baltic states, are saying, we will contribute if you will stand behind us and stand behind NATO.
I think it's interesting that it's actually some of the smaller states like Lithuania that are struggling but endeavoring to meet their requirements, where some of the larger states like Germany are actually the ones that are falling behind. And of course, you know, NATO really always thought that Germany was going to be a major player, but now you've got German politicians who say, well, can't taking refugees in be part of our NATO contribution? How do you square this circle where the most relevant European powers are the least interested in participating?
I think that part of that has to do with getting comfortable with the sort of the post-World War II international order of this, like, oh, well, war is never going to happen again. It's not possible. Whereas these smaller countries are saying, no, it's actually quite possible, and we're pretty worried about it, and we understand the importance of military spending. And so some of it, I think, is this becoming overly content and overly comfortable that some of these larger countries have been experiencing because they haven't had serious national security threats in some time.
Well, Megan, that is an excellent point. I really appreciate you joining us today to talk about some of these national security threats. I know the listeners here at Secure Freedom Radio have no illusions as to the threats that the United States and really the entire world face. So, Megan, thank you once again for joining us here on Secure Freedom Radio.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.